George.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the ninth and final session in our series on how and when, to some degree, if halacha adapts to modern times. We've covered a lot of ground over the last eight sessions, and we've gone right from the very beginning and looked at the earliest days of halakhic development. And what I'd like to do today is a little excursion into the future. As I said, to shift our time machine into forward gear and have a look at some of the sources, and I've brought for you here 40 sources on how halacha we think will change in the future. And to some degree, the future is now. We're already in a discussion as to maybe we are in a changed age. We'll get to that at the very beginning. Would you like a sheet? So let's have a look now. You have one from today? Okay, good. By way of introduction, let's look at a couple of sources which will tease us a little bit and, of things to come. There is a Gemara in Nida, in Samach Aleph, which talks about the following. The Shaila it's dealing with is a very interesting one, which is that if a person is being buried, are they allowed to be buried with shrouds made from shatnas or not? And the Gemara deals with this question as follows. Tana Rabbana, number one. Beged sha'avad boi kilayim. A garment in which shatnas is known to be included and cannot be found, it's been lost in there, it cannot be removed. What are you going to do with that beged? You cannot sell it to a non-Jew because there's a concern it might get sold back to a Jew and the Jew will be wearing shatnas. Aval, however, says the Gemara, there is one thing you can do with it. You can use it for a dead body to bury the dead. Amar Rav Yosef, Rav Yosef says, Zois Ameris, this leads us to understand mitzvahs betelois la'asid lavoi. The mitzvahs will one day be cancelled out. And with this he introduces this question. Will indeed mitzvahs be cancelled out one day? Will we enter a new era where there are no more mitzvahs, or at least as we know them? So there is now a debate in the Gemara where other people disagree. Amalei Abaya. So Abayah Rav Dimi says the following back for Ha'amar Rav Mani, Amar Rav Yanai, Loi Shanu Ela L'Safe. Surely we only allowed this shatner's shroud to be used for the hesped. In other words, you can put it around the dead. Everybody agrees that when the person is dead, then they don't have any mitzvahs. That's clear. So there's no problem in terms of the person when they're dead. The kasha is the problem is when they come back to life, in the future, they'll get out and they'll be wearing shatner's. So we only said maybe that halacha you can use a shatner shroud to do the hesped, but once you come to the kvura also, then you have to take it off. Amalei says no. Didn't Rabbi Yochanan say even to bury it? In which case, maybe there will be a cancellation of mitzvahs in the future. And so the Gemara answers not necessarily. Rabbi Yochanan l'tamei. Rabbi Yochanan is following the view d'amar Rabbi Yochanan, which is the view he takes elsewhere. Ma'idich siv b'meisim chofshi. Why are the dead called chofesh chofshi? Kiven shemeis adam. As soon as a person dies, nase chofshi min mitzvahs. They become free of mitzvahs. And therefore, it could be that this whole discussion is really nothing to do with the tchiyas ha-meisim. It's just to do with now the person's dead and they don't have to do mitzvahs, and therefore we're not concerned to bury a person with a shroud made of shatners. Whereas the first view, which was Rav Yosef's view, which is no, this is talking about when they finally get up from the dead and they will be wearing a shroud with shatners. I'm leaving aside the physical question as to, you know, when they come back to life, what will be left of their shrouds? How will that work? Maybe it's more of an allegorical idea, I'm not sure. It's difficult to understand exactly physically.
Excuse me,
is that the reason why there were seven garments of the person? The shrouds are complete
garments, complete outfits?
I don't know. Oh, so do they'll have what to... They look presentable. I don't know. I don't know if that's the origin of the minhagim as to how they dress a mace. I've no idea. Again, but on a physical level, you know, 1,000 years later, there's not going to be much left. But I don't know. I don't know. It could be. I'm not familiar with exactly the origins of those minhagim. Something to look into. Just one little side note. This idea of chofshi min ha-mitzvahs. This word choshi has always therefore been a word associated with people being free of mitzvahs, which is why liyos am choshi be'artzenu rang very hollow in the early days of Zionism, and the religious community objected to that line very strongly because they said, well, you see, that's exactly the point. Liyos am choshi be'artzenu. And there are people who are religious Zionists who sing Hatikva and change those words. They sing the whole thing, but they change those words.
When the word choshi was used, it wasn't put in there. It was
you know that? I don't know.
You know.
Words in poems have many reasons and many layers. So I'm not expressing an opinion on it. Excuse me?
Exactly.
Okay, let's go on. There are two words. This is a bit of Shavuos Torah, nothing to do with today, but there are two words for freedom in Lashon HaKodesh. Chofesh and Chairus. Chairus is the freedom that we're into. That's the Chairus of Shavuos, Charus al Aluchos, whereas Chofesh is perhaps the one we're not into. Now, let's have a look at source number two. The Talmud Yerushalmi, even though the Bavli seems to have a debate on whether mitzvahs will be cancelled, the Talmud Yerushalmi seems to say, no, they will not. Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Shimon, Bar Lakish, Rabbi Yochanan, Amar, Hanavim, Vahaksuvim, Asidim, Livatel. Here Rabbi Yochanan, who we saw at the end of source number one, says in the future the Nevi'im and Ksuvim, all those books of Tanakh, will be cancelled, will be irrelevant. But the five books of the Torah will never be cancelled. Ma'atayma, what is the reason? Kol gadol v'lo yosaf, which is at Sinai where the voice came out and will never, the never-ending voice of Sinai. We'll come back to this in the Rambam soon. The understanding is that the mitzvahs given on Sinai are never-ending le'olam va'ed, and therefore the Yerushalmi picks up that understanding and says, Rav Shimon bar Lakish Amar af Megillas Esther, even Megillas Esther, the halachas and the halachas of that area, Einon Asidim Libata, which is an interesting Shiloh. We'll get to Purim and Hanukkah towards the end of the Shia. But the Yerushalmi seems to basically take the view that the Torah will not be cancelled in the future. The Torah is eternal. Yes. There is another source elsewhere that says that all of the books will be cancelled apart from Chamishei Chumshei Torah and the book of Yoshua, because of the return to Eretz Yisrael. You will see soon that these issues became important in the polemic between the Jews and the Christians during the Middle Ages. Because the Christians, especially when we'll see the Ramban, his vikuach against Pablo Cristiani in Barcelona, they obviously wanted to prove that mitzvahs, now that the quote-unquote Mashiach had come from a Christian perspective, there were no more mitzvahs anymore. In other words, these sources were used by them to try and justify the abandonment of mitzvahs in a messianic era. And this became part of the whole debate, but we're not dealing with the Christian angle of it, we're dealing with the original sources, if you like. The Rambam actually does rule that a shroud may be used for a dead body, but he seems to have no interest in the issue of Tchiyas HaMeisim here, which we'll see is consistent with the Rambam. Look at number three, Mutal Asos Min HaKilayim Tachrichin LeMeis. You can use shatness for a mace. She'ein ala maceim mitzvah. Very straightforward. A mace doesn't have to do a mitzvah. It's nothing to do with tchias maceim. However, the Shulchan Aruch, when he brings his halach in number four, tachricha mace mutal asoiv mikilaim, afilu lekoivro behem, even to do the kvura, the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch do raise this issue of tchias maceim. Look at the Taz at the end of number four. Dibba begadim shekoivro moisoi hu acid la'amoid behem. He will stand up in these shrouds eventually, etc. So, this issue of burying a mace in a shroud with kilayim, it really depends on how you look at it. According to those who are more grounded, if you like, in the here and now, the reason is because the mace is mace and doesn't have to do mitzvahs. According to others who are more looking toward the end of days, if you like, eschatological in their understanding, they're thinking, well, no, the whole point is they'll come back to life and they won't have any mitzvahs because mitzvahs will be cancelled out. We'll see soon. The Rambam's view is clearly that mitzvahs will never be cancelled out, and therefore he doesn't go for that. Yes? Well, he's a kohen gadol.
Okay, so who knows if it's maybe
we'll all be kohen in gedolim. It's a chiddush. It's a chiddush. Now, there is. If I could lend some support to what you're saying, there is an interesting question from last week's Haftorah from Yecheskel, where he seems to give all of the Kohanim the halachas of the Kohanim Gedolim. where he says a Kohen is not allowed to marry an Almona, and a Kohen is allowed to marry an Almona. So why is Cheskel saying a Kohen is not allowed to marry an Almona? Because he's saying no, because in the Imos HaMashiach, the Kohenim will all be upgraded to the level of Kohenim Gedolim. That I heard by the Kohenim, but the Israelim is an upgrade I never heard yet. But why would Shatnez be allowed Dafka as opposed to... Okay, so who knows? You're right, okay, we'll see that this is... I've not seen anyone who suggests that Shatnez is a special case because of the Kohenim Gedolim. It's already half a foot out of the door because we see other people wear it. This is seen as a paradigm for all mitzvahs, that all mitzvahs will be gone, and Shatnez is one of them. Let's have a look now. Let's bring it back down. That was just a teaser. Let's bring it back down to earth and look at the future in a more proximate way. And what I want to do is as follows. I want to take you for the next hour, in Yetzer Hashem, through four or five different periods in terms of the future. Number one, the establishment of sovereignty in Eretz Yisrael. Does that change halacha in some way? Question. Number two, further forward, the majority of the Jews living in Eretz Yisrael, which is also not so far away, Bezrat Hashem, does that also change the way halacha moves? Number three, what happens when Eliyahu HaNavi comes? How does that work, and what effect will that have on the halachic process? Number four, what about Mashiach? And number five, what about Tchiyas HaMeisim? And once we've got past Tchiyas HaMeisim, I don't have anything else to say. So let's start with perhaps the more current and practical issue of Jewish sovereignty. So I have two sources to bring on this. The first one is from Rav Zevin. Rav Shlomo Zevin says here in Tchumin. Tchumin is a book of articles on different issues of the Medina and related ideas. And he asked an interesting question here. Aval haMedina haMukemes Achshav. The current state of Israel, he's writing this already about 30, 40 years ago, raises the following important question. In connection with all of Eretz Yisrael, in other words, Medinat Yisrael has an impact maybe on Eretz Yisrael. We know, historically, the original Kedushas HaAretz came with Yoshua. And then the land was conquered by Nebuchadnezzar. And the Jews left, Sabava. The land then came, they came back, and Ezra and Nehemiah gave the land a new Kedusha. It was called Kedusha Shnia by the very fact that they established a Jewish country in the land. Loimach was Kibush. It wasn't because of the fact that they conquered the land, because Ezra and Nehemiah never conquered the land. They were given the land by the non-Jewish authorities. Because they settled in the land, even though it was controlled, if you like, ultimately by outside forces. He says, leaving aside whether you want to be Zionist, non-Zionist, the fact is that there is a Medina, there is a Jewish state in this country. Does that reintroduce Kedusha Shlishis, which will change halacha? Maybe we have reignited the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. It's clear we have an independent control over the land. With God's help. Even greater than the Ole Babel. The Ole Babel were actually physically controlled by a power, the Persians and the Greeks. We are, in theory, independent. We still have people in the White House pulling strings and in the Kremlin pulling strings, which affect us, but it's no less independent than Ezra and Nehemiah were. Okay, the kitzutz ha-shetach shel eretz einu mafri l'kudusha haba al yidei chazaka, and the exact boundaries of Eretz Israel, maybe it's not the exact biblical boundaries, that makes no difference. U'b'chein, and therefore, l'shitas ha-sovrim sh'akudusha shnia af hi b'teila in golas kitus. And therefore, maybe even according to the opinion that the Kedusha Shnia went when the Romans conquered the land, ulait is chadesh achshav im hakamas hamadina. Maybe today the Kedusha Shnia will be reignited because of the state of Israel and the chazaka of the Jews living here. But Pilo Shitas Rambam, and even according to the Rambam, she Kedusha Shnia kayemet, that the Kedusha Shnia never left. Even until today, maybe we have a new Kedusha over the Negev, because, of course, Ezra and Nehemiah never went to the Negev. The Negev was not part of the Judean state during the Second Temple period, but now it is. And therefore, maybe the Negev has been reignited with Kedusha. Of course, this has all sorts of impacts on different halachas of Shemitah, of Truma, of Maaseh. And again, I think this question is independent of whether you take politically positive or negative views or neutral views of the nature of the secular state. The fact is that Jewish people are living here and have a chazakah over the land. That is undisputable. And therefore, the first question which I've raised here is Rav Zevin's question, which is maybe just the fact that we now have a Jewish settlement in Israel has already changed certain halachas hatluyas ba'aretz. But to widen the debate even further, I've brought you a more controversial source on page 2. This source is from a sefer by Rav Eliezer Berkovitz. Rav Berkovitz was a controversial character, and I've written in the note there that there were many towards the end of his life who really felt that he'd crossed the line out of Orthodox thinking into conservative thinking. That was it's not for me to express a view on the issue because I'm certainly not qualified. But there was a big debate on that, and others said, no, absolutely not. He just represents perhaps a different approach within Orthodox thinking to the nature of Torah. And therefore, I'm not, as I say, making any hachra'ah on that issue. But I did bring you here from a section from his book, Not in Heaven. And again, I would say that most of today's Orthodox thinkers would disagree strongly with what he said. But I wanted you to see what he said. Here, towards the end of his book, he says the following. Pick it up from the left-hand side, where it says page 136. He says, the history of the Oral Torah contains several milestones. Once the Mishnah was concluded, it was determined that subsequent sages could only interpret the Mishnah and not disagree with it. Correct? In cases of disagreement, one would have to find support from the opinion of a teacher of the Mishnah, which is exactly what we've been discussing for the last three or four sessions of Adas Yochid, and when can you use it, B'Shas Adchak, and not B'Shas Adchak. You're totally in line with that. Since the redaction of the Talmud, no one is permitted to agree with its teachings. Absolutely, the Hasimus HaShas, that's what we talked about at the very beginning of these lectures. Undoubtedly, these were protective measures dictated by exilic conditions, which is quite correct. The only reason that we ended up writing down and creating the Mishnah and the Gemara was because of the Golas. There's no shiloh about that whatsoever. We didn't have a Sanhedrin, etc. Had Jewish national existence been able to continue normally in the land of Israel, it is doubtful whether there would have been a formal conclusion of the Mishnaic period, which again is undisputable because it only happened because of the Golas. One may ponder what form of Talmudic-type Mishnah interpretation would have developed, yes, one may, without ever reaching even the semblance of an answer. Absolutely, it's hypothetical. These authority barriers seem to depart from the rule of Torah, with which we have already become familiar, that one must turn to the judge of his own days. Indeed, except that the judge of our own days does not exist. In other words, there's nothing controversial about what he's saying so far, which is that in theory, Torah has to be dynamic and changing, and each Sanhedrin has to reinterpret Torah, but we got stuck with a Mishnaic and Talmudic system which was frozen because of the exile. There is absolutely nothing controversial with that whatsoever. Now he goes on, however, the next paragraph. The exilic form in which the oral Torah and with it halacha have reached us may indicate the seriousness of the problem confronting a jury that believes its future lies in halachic duties. The twofold exile of halacha, from reality into literature and codification, forced it into a straitjacket as we face the challenges of our time. And now this is where he begins to become a little bit controversial, because he's saying that, okay, fine, we've had this imposition of Talmudic structure, which we had to do, and there's no question about it, but surely now it's time to unfreeze the system a bit. Nowhere is this felt more severely than the modern state of Israel. After almost two millennia of exile, halacha has been given back its authentic partner, the daily reality of the life of a Jewish people living in its own land. It is the commanding opportunity for the realization of the Torah of the land of Israel, which is like no other Torah. Torah Eretz Yisrael. And here, he's not just talking about Shemitah and Trumas and Maestros. He's talking about Torah in its widest sense, now becoming enlivened, if you like, by its connection with Eretz Israel. Halacha has once again a comprehensive form of Jewish reality to work with, a broad field of Torah application to life, political, economic, social, ethical. Once again, Torah may move from the private congregational domain to which exile had limited it into the public domain of a nation? And this is a good question, which is, halacha has only been dealing with relatively private matters for the last 1,600 years. It now has to deal once again with big public issues. How do we fight wars? How do we engage in foreign policy? Which it never really had to deal with in the exile. Halacha, which in exile had to be on the defensive, building fences around communal islands, now ought to resume its classical function and originate new forms of relevant Torah realization in the state of Israel. It should concern itself with questions of social justice, economic honesty, fairness, with problems of labor relations, the work ethos, with the social gap, with ethics, morality, even with such matters as traffic laws in the cities and on the highways. How is the Sabbath to be observed in a highly industrialized society that depends on continuous process industries that cannot be turned off every Friday at sunset? These are good questions. What do we do with cows that need milking on a nationwide scale on Shabbos? Do we get non-Jews in? Do we have grommer machines? How do we do this? Are they to be serviced only by non-religious Jews, such just as the police force, for instance, is to be recruited only from non-Sabbath observant citizens? Is this what the Torah intended by a Jewish people living in its own land, a land dependent on the Jewish Shabbos goy? How do we integrate the Chiloni community into a halachic country? Do we use them as Shabbos goyim? Unfortunately, on all these and related issues, halacha is silent today. For the time being, halacha is in exile in the land of Israel, as it was before in the lands of Jewish dispersion. It is still the halacha of the shtetl, not that of the state. As yet, we have not become worthy of the Torah of the land of Israel, and the reasons are to be found in what happened to the halacha during its exile. Now, it's very interesting. The question is, you know, what to do with it? Is it something that we can work with and change halacha in some way? Or is it just a thin end of the wedge into conservative Judaism? You can ask other people about that. But I think the questions he raises are very good questions. And does the existence of our new matzav, which is so new, really, we're only just coming to terms with it, it's only 50, 60 years old, how does that impact on the need to make, you know, fundamental changes in the way that halacha works? Or does it at all? Yes. Ger Toshav. But that itself is a good question. Are you suggesting the return to a Ger Toshav type status for non-Jews in Israel, which is itself a very controversial question? Are the non-Jews around us now just the same old non-Jews that were around us in Poland, except they happen to be living here? Or are they now different? You know, Bnei Noach living in a Jewish sovereign state, etc., etc. That itself is a great question. There are, of course, the technological shift is part of this as well. What's this? Okay, the cows is just one micro example of other things. I just gave this to you because I think it raises some fascinating questions. I'm not pretending it's mainstream in terms of Orthodox thinking, it's not, but I just wanted you to see it. Now, move on please to page 3. I tell you, I didn't bring the rest of the book, which is, I like the questions that he raises. He then goes for 30 pages giving answers that he feels would be fine. And those answers are very controversial about how to deal with the Aguna problem and how to deal with other issues. And during his life, these were issues which were controversial. That's a great question, and I'm not really interested in his answers, because I think his questions are much more probing than the answers. Often the questions are much better than the answer in all areas of life. Have a look at number 3. Page 3, rather. Now, let's talk about the majority of Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. The Rambam has a halacha in Hilchos Trumas in number 7. Hatruma bizman hazeh, va'afilu b'mokam shehichziku oyle babel, even in the place where the Jews did have a chazaka and a kedusha, and leaving aside Rabbi Zevin's question as to whether the new state makes a new kedusha, the Rambam holds the old kedusha is still here. He holds it still here. Va'afilu b'yemei Ezra, even in the days of Ezra, ainu min ha-Torah. It's no longer min ha-Torah. Ela midivrehem, the whole thing is midrabon and trumas and maestras. She'ein lecha truma shel Torah ela be'eretz Yisrael bevad. You certainly only have truma in Eretz Yisrael. U'bizman shekol Yisrael sham, and only when the whole Jewish people is there. She'ne'emar, it says, and this is an important posik, kisavo'u, when you come, to which the Chazal understood that meant bias kulchem, and these are two important words. Biat kulchem, when everybody counts. Just like it was originally with Yoshua, and just like the Jews will come back in the third resettlement of Israel, says the Rambam, that will be the case then too. Like Shehayu b'Yerushalayim, but not like it was with Ezra. Shehayse b'Yemei Ezra, Shehayse b'Yas Miksasam. Very few Jews came back to Israel in the time of Ezra. The vast majority remained in Bavel, which was a source of great concern and upset to Ezra and Nehemiah. Well, if he kachloi chay va'oisem in Atorah, therefore trumas and masras is not in Atorah. V'chein yir Elisha who had din b'masras, this is masras too. Shein chayvim b'zman hazeh elim edivrehem k'trumah. The question of Shemitah is a little bit more complicated, and there are other issues, but according to some poskim, the same is true of Shemitah, and that Shemitah today is midrabonon for the same reason. The same is true of Chala, Truma, Maisa. The whole question of the Heter Mechira for Shemitah year only gets off the ground on the basis that Shemitah today is midrabonon. And you can start from that point and move forwards. On the basis that Shemitah today is Doraisa, Heter Mechira has a very weak basis on which to move forwards. By the way, all of the Jewish people coming back does not mean all. The Sefer Chinuch says in number 8, on the mitzvah of challah, but na'egitz b'zchorim u'kevus, it applies to men and women, be'eretz Yisrael, bilvad midoraisa, only in Eretz Yisrael midoraisa, sh'ne'emar ba'achalchem milechem ha'aretz, ba'achlechem milechem ha'aretz. The Dafki of his master Kol Yisrael Sham, and it only applies when all the Jews are there. Kolayma, that means Rubam. The majority, and we see all through the Torah. All through the Torah, there is a principle of Rubo Kakuloi. Once you have a majority, that represents the majority, that the entirety. And that indeed, I brought you another little piece in number 9 from Rabbi Zevin, who also clearly comes to that conclusion. Once you have the majority of the Jews in Eretz Yisrael, then somehow halachic wheels start turning. Trumas and Maisas and Chala suddenly turn Midoraisa, Shemitah is uncontroversially then Midoraisa, and that will make a difference. It will make a difference to how we do certain things in Israel. I brought you in number 10 an interesting comment. One study predicted in the next 80 years, this was written 10 years ago. In the next 80 years, so now 70 years, America's Jewish population would decline by 133.8 million if current fertility rates and migration patterns continue. Well, that makes certain assumptions. I suppose we can assume fertility patterns, but migration rates, I'm not sure. You know, the American establishment may encourage the Jews to make aliyah at a faster rate than they were expecting. You never know. In the same period, according to the study, the number of Jews in Israel would likely double, swelling to 10 million. The study also anticipated a severe decline in the number of Jews in the former Soviet Union. Well, that certainly happened. By 2018, the data suggested the Jewish community there would be virtually non-existent. Among the study's conclusions was that Israel will be home to the world's largest Jewish community as early as 2020, and the majority of the world's Jews by 2050. Between the years 2030 and 2040, the majority of Jews will be living in Israel rather than diaspora, where the communities are aging. And therefore, of course, not... I brought you the source here. The source is, I brought it at the bottom in the footnotes, an article by Hebrew U. It was a team of scholars in Hebrew U produced this for the American Jewish Yearbook in 2000. So it's 10 years ago. This is a trend which is accelerating, if anything. And there's aliyah now from all sorts of places, which even 10 years ago we didn't expect quite the same aliyah, France in particular. And therefore, once the majority of Jews get to Eretz Yisrael, this will be a very important halachic moment. This will also apply, the Sefer HaChinuch says, to Shichacha, Leket, and Peah, which will make, an interesting difference to the way we structure our agricultural economy. Will we once again find the farmers leaving the corners of the field and sheaves for people to pick up, and will there be organized chesed organizations which descend on fields and take figures? The Jews will respond to this change once this happens. I brought you a number 12, that Yovel, we have to wait a little bit longer, because for Yovel to apply, it's not enough the majority of Jews live in Israel, but there have to be representatives, at least representatives, from all tribes. The Rambam brings that down. As soon as Reuben and Shimon were taken away from Eva Hayarden, then Yovel ceased to exist. So even in the Second Temple, there was no Yovel. But once we have the return of the exiles, then Yovel will come back. So, okay, fine, we'll work it out. There'll something with the return of the exiles come other things like Eliyahu Hanavi. We'll come to him in a minute. Just before we get to Eliyahu Hanavi, let's deal with one other thing which has perhaps current application. We saw the issue of sovereignty in Eretz Israel is current. The issue of the majority of Jews coming to Israel is Be'ezrat Hashem almost with us. What about the Sanhedrin? Now, this is very interesting because every few hundred years there is a new attempt by the Jewish people to reestablish the Sanhedrin. It's very clear from the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvahs that the existence of the Sanhedrin does not depend on the Temple. It does not depend on the Beit HaMikdash. If I could just point out a couple of issues here. Number 13. HaMitzvah HaKuf Ayin Vav. We have a mitzvah to appoint judges. They have to be on a very high level, and we'll see they have to have smicha, not what we today call smicha, which is just, you know, a permission to be a rabbi somewhere, but the real smicha. The real smicha, which entitles a dayan to sit on the Sanhedrin to judge Sanhedrin cases. They need that for sure. These may be Yerushalayim, based in HaGadol. They will be appointed in Yerushalayim, based in HaGadol, Mishivim Dayanim, of 70 Dayanim. Ukvan nichval atzibo yazem lino shivim zekenim, v'hu amras Hashem, amri yisparach l'moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, atpuli shivim ish, gather together 70 people, kloima, shehudava matzmid, this is a constant mitzvah, ve'einu mitzvah lefisha, not a temporary mitzvah, aval hu royim uchuyiv l'doirei doiras. This applies in all generations. They have to be in Eretz Israel. There is only smicha in Eretz Israel. Once we get smicha back in Eretz Israel, then once we get smicha back, we can start getting the Sanhedrin back, and they can start making judgments. They won't make din in nefoshes capital cases. That we have to wait for the temple. But the halacha seems very clear in the Rambam that before the temple, we can have a new Sanhedrin. All we need is people with smicha. Then we can make a Sanhedrin. When the temple is built, then we'll get on to capital cases, but we don't need to wait for the temple for the Sanhedrin. And indeed, the Rambam himself in the Mishnah Torah gives a suggestion as to how to kickstart, how to jumpstart that process. Look at number 14. Nirinli, it seems to me, says the Rambam, Nirinli hadvarim she'im hiskimu kol hachachamim sheva Eretz Yisrael. If all of the Jews in Eretz Yisrael agree limnos dayanim, to appoint judges, the lismoy chaysam, and to give them smicha, Hari elu smuchim. They then become authentic smuchim. The yesh lehem ladun dinei knasos. They can have all the dinim of fines and things that only musmachim can. The yesh lehem lismoich la'acherim, and they can then give smicha to others. In kein lama hayu acharim mitzdarim ala smicha. So why were they worried about not having smicha? Why were the chachamim upset they didn't have smicha? Let them make a new smicha. Lafi, that was only because she Israel mufurazim, that the Jews were scattered. The EF Sheyaskim, they weren't able to agree, Kulan, all of them. The Imhayusham Somoch Nipi Somoch, Elatarach Daz Kulam. And if you found somebody who had the original smicha, then you don't need any of this, you can just start with him. But if you don't, then you need to get everybody together and restart the process. Now, based on this Rambam, as I'm sure you're aware, in the 1500s, Rav Yaakov Beirav in Sfat, which was the main Jewish town in Israel, got all the Chachamim together in Sfat and said, we're going to restart Smicha. And they gave Smicha to Rav Yosef Karo and to a number of other people. They gave it to the Alshich, and with a view to starting a new Sanhedrin. Don't forget, they lived in a post-Holocaust generation. The 1492 had destroyed the Jews of Sfarad, and there was a very strong feeling that Mashiach was coming. There was a return to Eretz Israel to some degree. There was a new Aliyah, all the communities of Sfat, etc. And there was something in the air, there was something messianic in the air, and they thought the Sanhedrin would be part of this process. What happened just historically was that the Jews of Yerushalayim, who were very much the smaller community, said, one second, we weren't part of this process. You can't just unilaterally produce smicha in Sfat. We have to be part of it, and we don't agree. and therefore there was a big political hoo-ha. There were letters going back between Rabbi Yaakov Bei Rav and the Jews of Yerushalayim, and needless to say, the whole thing ground to a halt and didn't happen, and the smicha and the Sanhedrin never caught on. What did catch on was Rabbi Yosef Karo's response to this failure of the Sanhedrin, which was to write the Shulchan Aruch, which in itself is, if you like, a mini kind of Sanhedrin, which is a psak for the Jewish people as a whole. It didn't come in a vacuum. It came as a result of the failed smicha process. But the fact is that throughout generations there have been other people that tried this. There was a moment in the 19th century with Napoleon where there were people who really felt there was a messianic something in the air. And Napoleon himself set up something which was a bit of a sham, but he called it his Sanhedrin. I'm sure you're familiar with this historically. In France, in the early 1800s, he put together 70 rabbis to make a new Sanhedrin. The truth is they weren't musmachim on any level. Some of them were Gedolei Torah, mamash. They were the leading generation, people of the generation. Some of them were reform rabbis and people like that. So it didn't get off the ground, but there have always been attempts. Now, in 1948, of course, people also, just like in the early 1500s, post-Holocaust generation, return to Israel, something messianic in the air. There have been movements to restart the Sanhedrin, and there is indeed today a group of people who call themselves the Sanhedrin, who are trying to raise awareness of this issue. If you're interested in reading about this, I brought you two links to two articles on the web. One is a rather skeptical article about how the modern Sanhedrin, quotes and quotes, is a joke, written by something of a negative perspective. And the other is the actual Sanhedrin's website, thesanhedrin.org, which of course is to be expected. Of course, I'm sure in due course there will be mashiach.com and eliyahuanavi.com, unless there's some other way of disseminating the message. There's no reason to expect that won't happen, but you can go on their website and see what it's all about. Fine, they even meet in Har Nof from time to time. I've seen the Sanhedrin in the Datilumi Hall. The question is whether this is going to have any effect or not. Was this? Pretty derisory. I mean, it's a joke, basically. They say they are the Sanhedrin, but they want to build it into build a head of steam and, you know, get everyone to accept it. So you can go on the website, it'll give you all their names. And the religious Zionists, they're almost all from the religious Zionist community. Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz was the Nasi of this Sanhedrin, quotes and quotes, for a while, then he stepped down. It's obviously mired down in politics, no question about it, and it seems that we're not quite there yet, but in principle there's no reason why this can't happen tomorrow morning. There isn't. If everyone tomorrow morning wakes up and says, okay, boys and girls, let's get on with it, time for a Sanhedrin, and of course, once there is a Sanhedrin, and again, there's no halakhic reason why not, then the things that Rav Eliezer Berkovitz was talking about don't seem so far-fetched anymore. Because then there is a group of people who do have the halakhic authority to unfreeze some of the decisions that were made in the Talmud. And then really, you're into a whole new world of halacha, which is something just worth thinking about. Let's move forward even a stage further. The coming of Eliyahu. We have a tradition based on a Mishnah going even further back, number 415, Amar Rav Yeshua, Mekubal Ani Mi Rabban Yochanan Ben Zakkai. I have a tradition from Rav Yochanan Ben Zakkai, Sheshame Mi Rabbi, who heard from his rabbi, the Rabbi Mi Rabbi, Halocha Le Moshe Mi Sinai, all the way back to Sinai, She'ein Eliyahu Ba Letame Uletahor. He doesn't come to change the yichus of people. That's not Eliyahu's job. L'rachek u'l'kareif. He's not coming to push people away, say, really, you're not Jewish, really, you are Jewish. What is he coming to do? Reb Shimon Aymer l'hashvot ha-machlokes. He's coming to stop machlokes. V'chachamim marim lo l'rachek lo l'kareif el alas o shalom ba'olem. He's coming to make shalom in the world, shenei mar. Hidin shalach lachem es Eliyahu ha-navi, etc., etc. V'heshiv lev avos al-bonim v'lev bonim al-avosam. The last of the Nevuas of Malachi, who was the last of the Nevi'im, was this promise that I will send you Eliyahu HaNavi, who will come and bring Shalom back to the world. Based on this Mishnah, the Tosfos Yontov brings in the famous idea, number 16, Reheshiv Lev Avos Al Bonim, Kloima, Alachukim V'Amishpatim, Yishva Lev Avos Al Bonim, on all the details of law the Eliyahu Navi will bring the fathers and the children back together. Shalaitia oid machloikas by name, but there won't be any more machloikas. Venira lida mihacha regilin lima de teku, and therefore the word teku, which you see many hundreds of times in the Gemara Bavli, in the Shalmud Bavli, which literally speaking, literally grammatically means tehei tai, let it stand, which is the way that the Gemara answers an irresolvable question. When the Gemara is not prepared to come down one side or the other on the question, says teku, means the Gemara has paskened that this question may not be answered. It is left as a suffix. As opposed to, by the way, when the Gemara answers kasha, sometimes the Gemara says kasha, which just means we're not prepared to answer this right now, but future generations, Rishonim, Achronim, they can work it out. Teku doesn't mean that. Teku means this question is unanswerable. And as I say, grammatically it means let it stand. But he goes on to say, Regilim Lomo, de Teku Sha'amru B'Gemara, he notrikon, this actually is a notrikon, it's an acronym, Tishbi Yitaretz Kushiois Verbios. The Tishbi, who of course is Eliyahu, because he comes from the town of Toshav, in Eber HaYarden, it's just in Jordan, town of, it's still there, there's a kind of archaeological site there, El Ishtib or something like that. He will answer all of the questions. Even though the grammatical reason is let it stand, then Tishbi Yitaretz Kushiois Verbios. And therefore, there is this idea that Eliyahu Navi will come and he will resolve all of these halachic questions. Now, I brought you a piece of number 17 from the Encyclopedia Talmudit, which makes an interesting distinction, which is one which I was taught in yeshiva, which there's a difference between Tishbi and Eliyahu. Eliyahu and Tishbi are the same person, but they have two different roles. Just like the Rambam says, even though this is not everyone's view, but the Rambam clearly says, a Navi is not allowed to decide halacha, loy b'shamayim hi. A Navi is, however, allowed to decide questions of fact. And therefore, the Gemara is very careful to sometimes say, tehei munach ad sheyavu Eliyahu. This has to stay until Eliyahu comes, because Eliyahu will now decide this question of fact. Things that, I don't know what this is, where this is, how much fell in here, how much fell in there, that the Navi can decide. However, questions of halacha, Eliyahu has to take off his Navi hat and put on his rabbi hat, and that's Tishbi Yitaretz Kushiois Verbios. And therefore Eliyahu Navi will come and decide all these questions, and that also will change halacha. Because a whole bunch of questions which remain sophic will all of a sudden become clear. For want of a better example, our fifth cup on Seder night, which is the Koshel Eliyahu, which is called the Koshel Eliyahu because it's waiting for Eliyahu to come and decide whether we need four cups or five cups. So we'll know whether we have to drink the fifth cup, but that's just one example of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of examples which will change halacha when Eliyahu comes. Yeah. No, that's a halachic issue. Kosher Tishbi. I don't know how accurate the expression is, Kosher Tishbi, Kosher Eliyahu. Good question. The Kedushas Levi I saw raises a good question, which is, makes a certain assumption, which is, why do I need Eliyahu to answer all these questions? Surely, by Tchias HaMesim, I'll turn to Moshe Rabbeinu. I mean, if there's Moshe Rabbeinu, who needs Eliyahu HaNavi? But of course, the answer to that, on some level, is that who's talking about Tchias HaMesim? Eliyahu HaNavi is part of a process which perhaps is entirely independent of Tchias HaMesim. And Tchias HaMesim may be way, way, way in the future, and Eliyahu HaNavi will have an impact on the halachic process long before we get into any discussion about Tchias HaMesim. So we are waiting for Eliyahu, and this, as far as we're concerned, is something which will come sooner or later. We now go into the issue of Mashiach. Now, there's a lot to be said about Mashiach, although I will preface my remarks by something the Rambam says in the Halachas of Mashiach that he brings at the end of the Mishnah Torah, which is, we really don't know what's going to be with Mashiach. There are many different views. We don't know even if Eliyahu is going to come before Mashiach or after Mashiach. We don't really know whether the temple is going to be built before Mashiach, as it seems to say in the Yerushalmi. We'll build the temple, then Mashiach will come, or Mashiach will come and then he'll build the temple. We don't really know whether the Jews will be brought in from the exile before Mashiach or after Mashiach. There's a lot we don't know. And the Rambam says there's a good reason why we don't know that, because Chazal had no Kabbalah, they had no Klal Masorah on Mashiach, because it's always going to be a little bit fuzzy, and maybe there are multiple options for how it will happen, depending on us. However, there are some basic things which we do know, and this is what I want to draw to your attention now. Will Halacha change in Yemos Mashiach? Have a look at number 90. The Gemara in Shabbos says like this: Af Shloima Amul Chachmasui Zchay Ez Barecha B'Yemei Bachurecha B'Bachurasecha. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Actually, Yah Yemei Hara, before the evil days come. When Shlomo had talking about, says the Gemara, Eli Yemei Mashiach. These are the days of Mashiach. She'ein behem loy zchus veloy chayva. There is no merit and there is no sin in Yom Mashiach. And this is disagreeing with the opinion of Shmuel, the Amar Shmuel, because Shmuel says, "Ein bein olam hazeli mosa Mashiach." The only difference between today's world and Mashiach, the Messianic world, el shibul malchus bilvad, is the rule of the nations. Shneimar ki lo yechdal evyon mikerev haaretz. And built into this Gemara, therefore, is a fundamental disagreement, which we'll see is picked up in later years by the Rishonim. Will Mashiach look just like our world today, except for one major change, which is world peace, but everything else will be the same? You'll still need to earn a parnasa, you'll still need people who get sick and who are poor, and we'll still need gamas, and everything will be exactly the same in terms of natural life, just that we won't have people spending hundreds of billions of dollars on weapons. They'll be spending that money on cures for cancer, and we'll be in collaboration with the Arabs and not against them, and they'll work with us. This is a world of where Shibud Malchias, where world domination against the Jews is gone. But everything else is the same. I mean, that's pretty miraculous in and of itself. But it's not an open miracle. The very fact of that there is such a thing as the United Nations, for all its flaws and for all the fact that it doesn't work and it's anti-this and it's anti-that, the concept is a messianic concept. The concept of the world's nations coming together to speak together as one voice with all its problems is a messianic idea, which would have been unthinkable even 100 years ago. So that's one view, and the other view is no, a miraculous time, ein chus, ein chayva, there's no sin, there's no merit, the whole world changes in a fundamental way. Now, as is I think well known, the Rambam paskens in number 20, Amru Chachamim, he doesn't even say Shmuel, he says the rabbis, ein bein olam hazeh yemos haMashiach leShibul Malchus bilvad. The only difference between today's world and the world of Mashiach is world peace, but everything else is the same. And he fleshes that out, number 21. King Messiah will come and return the kingship of David to its original form. The Memshala HaRishona, and create a sovereign state. So Mashiach is political Jewish sovereignty, says the Rambam. He'll build a temple, and he'll bring back the exiles. And he says clearly, all the halachas will return in Mashiach's time to how they were before. Makrivin korbonus, we will bring korbonus. Va'os in shmitin, we'll keep shmita. Va'yovel kachol mitzvah ha'amur b'tayim. So the Rambam is very clear. Do not expect halacha to change when Mashiach comes. It will just go back to its full pristine state when we have the Jews here, and all the halachas will apply like they used to do. And indeed, in number 22, the Rambam in Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah says that the Torah will never, ever change. Number 22. Dava boru mufurish b'Torah shehi mitzvah oimedis le'olam uli'olnei olami. There will never, ever, ever be a change to Torah. Even, we'll see, after Tchias HaMesim, which is a funny thing. I mean, Tchias HaMesim, dead people coming up from the ground, surely that sounds like a very supernatural world. Says the Rambam, I don't know, but all I know is halacha will be the same. There is an interesting piece by Rav Aryeh Kaplan. He has a book called Immortality, Resurrection, and the Age of the Universe, where he suggests, and this is 40 years ago, in the 70s, that Tchias HaMesim could happen in an entirely naturalistic way through cloning technology. All you need is a little bit of DNA, and he said this before people had even kind of done this. He was a physicist. He was a scientist of a serious stature. All you need is a bit of DNA. You stick it together, you clone it into a person, and then, collect all the DNA from all the people that are dead, and then you can remake them. Okay, you'll remake them as babies, but then you can grow them back into the people that they were before, which is very, very interesting. And they even have an application to this idea of this in the Midrash, that there's always a little bit left, this luz, this little bit of the person that never fully decomposes. I'm sure you've heard this idea before. So says Rav Kaplan, if I remember rightly, maybe this is the DNA, maybe this is the thing that is left of them, and you could bring all these people back. Which is an incredible idea, if you think about it. So we'll see in due course. Maybe DNA cloning will, by that time, be totally old technology. It'll be not something new. You can just zap somebody and, I don't know, whatever. But this idea that we have of graves opening and people kind of coming out of graves, maybe that's just our own, childish imagination. Maybe it'll be much more sophisticated than that. There's someone coming back from the dead right now. Okay, let's. So I'm just throwing that out to you as a possibility. So he says, the don't worry about it. The halacha will never ever change. Back to 22. Shh. Ein la'loy shinui. There's no change. La'loy giron and nothing taken out. La'loy tosefes, nothing added in. Halamata, this teaches us ad oilam. And this, of course, is a swipe at the Christians, which is that even if, which is clearly not the case, but even if you were right and your Messiah was the real Messiah, then what happened to your Torah? You can't just drop Torah. That is impossible. It's ridiculous. Torah is forever, and your whole idea never gets off the ground. I must say that the Rambam does. Even though he holds clearly la halacha that Christianity is Avodah Zorah, there's no question about that. He says it in a number of places. If you look in the uncensored version of the Mishnah Torah, which you can get hold of today, it's not so hard, you'll see at the end of his Hilchos Mashiach, he says, he makes a very long, has a very long comment there on Christianity and Islam. And he says that both Jesus and Muhammad were important stepping stones in bringing a pagan world towards the real Mashiach, towards the real monotheistic understanding of Mashiach, and therefore in God's, machshava, as it were, which is not ours, these are important moves on the way towards monotheistic, ultimate Mashiach, as it were. That's why, again, Rav Aryeh Kaplan wrote another book in which he called The Real Messiah, where he deals with a lot of these issues as well. Okay, the Rambam in number 23 describes Mashiach as a Novi, as a Talmid Chacham of immense proportion, and that the time being one of peace, contemplation. What will Mashiach look like for the Rambam? I'll leave you to read the source on your own. It'll be a time where we can make Parnassa very easily, not miraculously, but very easily, in order to free our time to do what we really need to do, which is learn, think, understand God, not be distracted by all the nonsense in the world. Says the Rambam, the real reason we don't have Nevi'im today, the real reason we don't have Torah like we used to, is not because of some intrinsic Yuridus Hadoiris. The Rambam doesn't subscribe to Yuridus Hadoiris. It's because the world's a big mess, and we haven't got the head for it, because every, few years we have to fight a war, or run away in a pogrom, or whatever it is. If we only had peace and quiet, we would go back up to the level that we were on, and the world would naturally return to the state that it existed in before. That's the Rambam's view of Mashiach. Look in number 24, HaMashiach Yemos Yomus, Mashiach will die, V'yimloch benoi, and his son will become Mashiach, or ben benoi, and his grandson. In other words, there'll be a new political reality, which will be normal and natural. Ukfar bir Hashem es Moisa. Hashem has already predicted the death of Mashiach. It talks about that. None of this business of Mashiach dying and being resurrected. It's natural. Okay? V'hesmin malchusa is man rab ma'oid. His kingdom will last for a great deal of time. V'gam yerchu chai b'nei odem. People's lifespans may well be, he says, increased. Again, through natural means. Ki beheza hadagos, because when you've got less to worry about, says the Rambam, the hatsoros, and less trouble in life, yerichu chai, people will live longer. And the truth is, even just the last 100 years, think of what's changed in the world that improves people's qualities of life and improves their lifespans. You know, it used to take people like 2 days to do the week washing. Now, what do? You shove it in a machine, press a button, and it does, The question is what you do with all that extra time. The answer is create an entertainment industry that just fills that time with other nonsense. That's the problem. See, that's why we don't live in the time of Mashiach. Because we shouldn't need an entertainment industry. We should be spending that time doing other things. Anyway, that's a separate issue. By the way, just on a slightly more, maybe a controversial note, Rav Kaplan, in the book The Real Messiah, most of the book deals with anti-missionary discussion and how to disprove missionary claims that Jesus was the Messiah. But at the end of the book, he has an appendix where he talks about the real messianic period, and he talks about the gradual unraveling of the curses of Adam and Chava. If you look at the end of the story of Gan Eden, you'll see that Adam and Chava were cursed with a certain number of things. One of those curses is to Adam that he wouldn't be able to earn parnasa without incredible toil and work. Okay? And eventually, says Rav Kaplan, when Mashiach is approaching, this curse will be gradually lifted, so that indeed bread will grow on trees, as it were, but not on trees, but maybe on supermarket shelves. And it's a very interesting thing. If you'd have taken someone 200 years ago to a supermarket in America, they'd have mamash thought they went to Gan Eden. What do you mean? I know how to make bread. You schlep like an ox. You plow a field. You plant corn. You water for months. You reap. You grind. You thresh. And eventually, at the end of that work, you produce a little piece of schmatazika like bread. You're telling me I can go to a supermarket shelf and go, boop, and it's done. That's unbelievable. That's Mashiach, no? Or maybe. Is it harder to work to earn to make a loaf of bread today, or was it harder 100 years ago? 1,000 years ago? It's a lot easier today. Another thing he says there, which is very interesting, is what's another curse? Another curse there is that women will have terrible pain in childbirth. Now, I'm not one to comment on childbirth, I've never done it, but one thing is for sure, even though childbirth is still a very traumatic experience, it's an awful lot less dangerous than it used to be. If you go back even 100 years and look at the number of maternal deaths in childbirth, it was very significant. In Victorian England, 30% of women died in childbirth. 30%. Today, Baruch Hashem, it's a fraction of a fraction of a percent of women that die in childbirth, letting alone the issue of epidurals, which would have seemed like Gan Eden, and maybe still do, to people who are giving birth. And finally, says Rav Kaplan, what about the other curse, which is that women will be subjugated by men? He says, you may be even seeing that one as well, a change in the run-up to Mashiach, where this whole difference of gender roles is becoming gradually re-equalized. Now, that's not to say that the feminist movement is the bringer of Mashiach, but I just leave it for your thought as to whether we are witnessing another curse being reversed. Anyway, that's just something for you to think about. Have a look, please, now at the alternative view. Look at page 6. The Ramban, Nachmanides, has a totally different... It's probably cold. Let's just turn this off for a second. We can turn it on again in 10 minutes. Shh. Oh, it's nice and quiet as well now. The Ramban, Nachmanides, has a totally different understanding of Mashiach. Have a look here, number 26. Says the Ramban on Devarim, Umar Hashem Elokecha es levavcha, Hashem will circumcise your hearts. V'nira min haksuvim inyan zeh she'oimer, ki bizman habriya ha'ith reshus b'yada adam la'afes k'ritzoin et tzadik or rosha. That a person has now, when they're created, a choice to choose either to be a tzadik or to be a rosha. We call this bechira choshes. V'chol zman ha'Torah came, this applies whenever there's a Torah. In other words, Torah is a response to people's freedom of choice. There's a freedom of choice, so God tells us, choose this, don't choose this. Eat kosher. Keep Shabbat, don't break Shabbat. We have a choice, do we do that, or do we not do that? Kedei she'yeh lehem zchus, so that we'll get a merit, but b'chirasam, when we make these choices, b'toiv. V'oinesh, and God forbid punishment, b'ritzayim, if we decide to do bad. Aval. V'yemois ha-Mashiach, when Mashiach comes, our bechira will cease to be like it is today, and we will have a natural, positive choice. And there'll be no tithe in our minds. Lamasha ain't a roi for what we don't is not appropriate for us. We just won't want it. Vihi amila, that is the circumcision haniskeres kam. When it says that Hashem will mal our hearts, our minds, it means it'll remove that barrier, which is the orla, which prevents us from being the way we should be. Ki hachemda v'hatayva orla le, because chemda, desire and lust, are just, if you like, the barriers to our minds. Umul halev, and circumcising our mind, hu shelo yachmo velo yitav. It means that we won't have this incredible yetzahara. The yoshev ha'adam bezman ha'hu, and at that time of Mashiach, man will return la'asher haya kodim chetai shal adam harishon. So the situation that we existed in before the chet, shaya oitze b'tivoy, we did naturally masheroi la'asos, what we should really do. Now, this is a whole different world. This is not the Rambam's world of natural Mashiach with world peace. This is Gan Eden, literally. We don't need mitzvahs. We don't need Torah. It's not a Zman Torah. We don't need korbanos. We don't need any of that. It's all finished. It's all gone. There's no purpose to it anymore. We're back in a world in which we exist in a Gan Eden-like state. And indeed in number 27, which is part of the Sefer Vikuach, which is his debate with the Christians, he says that the world of Mashiach, he's trying to tell the Christians, you think your Mashiach was the Mashiach? What exactly has changed in the world since your Mashiach came, except that everything's got much worse? Yeah, and he describes Mashiach, he says people will live forever, Mashiach will live forever, and again, this is not the view of the Rambam, this is very much a much more miraculous view. In 28, the Ramban describes the life of Adam and Chava before the sin, and basically says they had no rotzon, they were like malachim. They basically just did exactly like all of the other creations do, the sun, the moon. They did what God put them in this world to do, which is to connect with God. Only after the sin do we live. So Adam Arishan made a choice to eat the fruit. That's a good question as to how was he able to make that choice. That much Bechir was given, but he did it for the right reasons, the wrong reasons. He justified it, whatever. It was a different kind of sin. He didn't have the Yetzihara inside him. Yetzihara existed as an external. If you look in the Rambam, they see the snake represents an external Yetzihara, which is there and can affect and indeed got to us through Chava, and indeed got to Chava through Adam's mistake. Because if you look very interesting, the Mephoshim say that how did the snake persuade Chava that it was worth eating the fruit? So the Medrash says there that he said, is it true that you can't eat the fruit? So she says, we can't even touch the fruit. One second. Why did she think she can't touch the fruit? Because Adam told her, don't touch the fruit. Okay, why did he tell her don't touch the fruit? Because he didn't trust her. Because he says that God told him not to eat the fruit. And Adam thought, this is before she say, well, you know, if I tell her not to eat the fruit, so okay, I'll give her an extra like fence, and I'll tell her not to touch the fruit. What he should have told her, if he's to say this in hindsight, is that, Doraita, you're not allowed to eat the fruit. The Rabbanon, I think it's a good idea that we shouldn't touch the fruit. Had he educated her like that? Had he educated her like, no, yes to be machmir. No, yes to be machmir, but to understand that it's a chumrah. Oh, and then when the snake pushes her against the fruit and she touches it, and the snake says, she'd have turned around to him like an intelligent, educated woman and said, well, of course nothing happened when I touched the fruit, because that's the Rabbanon. The right there, I'm not allowed to eat the fruit. I'm actually only half joking. It's because of the inability and the refusal to teach her the halacha in a sophisticated way that the whole thing went sour in the first place. From here, if from nowhere else you see the imperative of teaching people halacha properly and not pretending that things which are chumras are actually daraisis. Very important. And not to have chumras, it's important, but to make sure people understand them. Anyway, all sorts of sources talk about the fact that halacha will be cancelled, like the Ramban. I'll point them out to you, I'm not going to get into all of them. The number 29 is the Midrash in Vayikra that says all of the korbanos will be abolished in the future world. It's funny, isn't it? Because people think, everyone knows the Rambam, Maimonides, took the view that korbanos were to some degree a temporary measure to bring us from human sacrifice to a more civilized state, which the Ramban, Nachmanides, goes ballistic over, nevertheless, it's clear that the Rambam is the one that holds there will be korbanos in Yemos HaMashiach, but the Ramban is the one that holds there will not. So you have to put, these views are not quite as straightforward as you think, and there's more to be said on that. There is also a statement that all the tefillah will be abolished in Yemos HaMashiach, and indeed that's in the Shulchan Aruch in number 30, Mizmor LaSoida. It's in Shacharis. Every morning we say Mizmor LaSoida. There's actually a halacha. People don't do this. I don't know why. There's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch, Mizmor LaSoida, Yesh La'amra Ben Negina. There is a mitzvah to sing Mizmor LaSoida. Yeah, Shekala Shiras, I see the Levatel, because all Shiras, all praises of God, will eventually be abolished. Chutz mi Mizmor LaSoida, apart from Mizmor LaSoida, and therefore, what should happen in Shacharis is everyone should mumble what they want to mumble, but in Mizmor LaSoida, everyone should whip out their tambourines and dance around the shul. I've never seen that. I don't know why they don't do it. And no doubt, if I started it, they still either say I was a lunatic fringe. It's in Shulchan Aruch. I brought you as an interesting aside, that Rav Kook's famous statements on his parish on Siddur, that we will have korbanos, but ultimately they will only be vegetarian korbanos. And he bases that on Psukim, and shows that only, and there were plenty of vegetarian korbanos. We have this idea that korbanos were all meat and blood. That's not true. There was flour, oil, wine, fruit, water, all sorts of things were brought to the Beis HaMikdash. Fruit technically wasn't a korban, but it was all brought to the Beis HaMikdash. What's this? Bikurim were fruit, exactly. So he says that eventually all meat, all fleshic korbanos will be cancelled. The reason being that the intelligence which comes down on the human race as part of Yemos HaMashiach will to some degree filter also down to the animal kingdom, which is a very interesting question as to how the animals and the humans will interact in the times of Mashiach. But this is all in the Ramban's miraculous understanding of Mashiach. Finally, in the last 5 minutes, let me just point out to you a few interesting things about Tchias HaMeisim. So, bottom line with Mashiach, we don't know which version of Mashiach will be the one we have. The non-miraculous, halacha-oriented Rambam version, or the miraculous Ramban version with no halacha, no Torah, apart from maybe a few remnant things of vegetarian korbanos, or, Mizmor LaSoida, or things like that. Yes? Mashiach Shal Yosef, Mashiach Shal David, is a Kabbalistic idea. The Rambam, as far as I'm aware, mentions it nowhere at all. It only comes out in the Kabbalistic writings, and it's not so straightforward that Mashiach ben Yosef is like another man like Mashiach ben David. Mashiach ben Yosef may be more of a system, a process, a structure. Indeed, the Rav Kook's philosophy on Mashiach ben Yosef was that the establishment of the secular state, to some degree, is Mashiach ben Yosef. That's what Mashiach ben Yosef means. It doesn't mean just one man from this tribe and then another man from another tribe. And the Rambam is not interested in it anyway, because he's not coming from a Kabbalistic perspective. Have a look, please, for the last few minutes, I'll just point out some of these sources. We saw at the very beginning with the Kilayim shrouds that maybe Halacha will change when Tchias HaMeisim comes, and indeed that is Tosfos' view in number 33. Look here, Aval Hachtikatanid Lechatchila Oisel Otachrichin Mikilayim. When we said that you can make shrouds out of shatnas, Afal Pikashiyamud Lasid Lamoid, even though when people stand up, they will be, in their clothes, shenikva behem, which they were buried in. Shmamina, we can learn from that. Shemitzas betelus laasid lavoi, in the world to come, and he's talking about Mashiach, it's a resurrection, mitzvahs will indeed be cancelled. The ritva in number 34 brings three views. One, that like the Ramban, that mitzvahs will be cancelled out straight away when Mashiach comes. One, like Shmuel, maybe the Ramban, that mitzvahs will stay for Mashiach but will be cancelled for Tchias HaMeisim. And one, finally, which is the most naturalistic, that mitzvahs will always, probably the Rambam's view, which mitzvahs will always stay even after Tchias HaMeisim, and maybe even Tchias HaMeisim will be natural in some way. Number 35, very famous Medrash, which is brought in the Ritva, that the pork will once again be kosher, which is why it's called a chazir, because the word chazir means to return. Midrash in number 26, which talks about the Livyason, and the behemoths, you know, killing each other, and us eating from the flesh of these animals, even though they weren't shechted properly, from which the Mishnah comes along and says, you can see from this, there'll be a Torah Chadasha Me'ititesa. This catchphrase, Torah Chadasha, that eventually in the next world there'll be a Torah Chadasha, this has always been something of a catchphrase. Will indeed there be a new Torah which comes in? And this also is part of the debate with the Christians. The Christians want to pick up on these Jewish sources and say, oh, you see, even you, see, for the Rambam, the Christians don't even get off base one. He's not interested. Torah is never going to change. For the Messianic Kabbalistic view, then we have to fight off the Christians, because the Christians can point to different sources and say, oh, you see, you believe in a Mashiach that changes the Torah, and the old Torah is abolished, and there's a new Torah that comes in. What's wrong with our version of that? And then we have to have a whole debate with them about that. There is an interesting medrash, we'll finish, which is number 37. Hashem Matir Asurim, which we say in davening, the God unbinds the bound. Mahu matir asurim. Yesh orim kol behema shenitmeis ba'olam hazeh matar oisa kodesh baruch la'asifoy. All the animals which were treif in this current world system will become kosher when in the future. But yesh orim eino matir la'asifoy. Some people say they won't. So what is matir asurim? Ein isa godel min anida, maybe even nida. Okay, which will be reversed, etc. And from here, you end up with this, not just Matir Asurim, but Matir Isurim. That's the play on words, which is Matir Isurim, which comes from these Midrashim, which is exactly what Shabtai Svi, as a false Messiah, jumped on and said, now is the time for Matir Isurim. Shabtai Svi did not invent Matir Isurim. People think he did. It comes from Midrashic sources, and I brought Sefer Ikrim, number 39, number 40, which I haven't got time for, which talks about the possible abolition of certain Isurim in the future, maybe not the Ten Commandments, maybe other ones. Shabtai Svi, of course, jumped on this and said, I am the Messiah, and I am allowed now to start making treif kosher, to cancel different Yomim Tovim and the fast days, etc., to allow certain sexual prohibitions, which he allowed, and the Jewish world got sort of whipped up into an incredible frenzy that this indeed was what was going on. Even today there are movements, there are very aggressive messianic movements in the Jewish world that start talking about Torah Chadasha and a new world and a new world order. This has always been very problematic for us in the past. Not yet. So we shall see what happens. By the way, Lahavdil, Christianity also started as basically a deviant sect of religious Jews who were religious but just believed in a Messiah that died and was coming back to life. And then one day they decided, well, actually we need to move forwards to a new religious system. Anyway, it's not clear what will happen in the future, but what's for sure is that there's a lot of sources discussing what might happen in the future, and with that, we're going to leave our 9-part series. We've covered a lot of ground, Baruch Hashem. We must have seen well over 350 sources over the last 9 sessions. I'd like to thank Machon Lander for hosting us and me, and say that it was a real pleasure being here over these sessions. I hope you enjoyed them. I hope that they'll be...
We also want to thank Roy Manning for a great semester, and we hope to have Roy Manning.